This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Sam, recording just after the close, Friday, July 15th. I got a birthday weekend here. My little one turns 4 years old tomorrow.
What? Going to get some ice creams and cakes, lemon cakes?
I think so, and cupcakes and who knows what else.
Sounds pretty good.
Sounds like a lot of sugar.
Sounds like a lot of sugar, and just wait for her demands to increase each year. So,
yeah, there's plenty of demands this year, so we'll try to keep it under control.
Yeah, we'll send some pictures.
All right, we'll do. Why don't we get into where are we? It was an interesting week this week. So, I think we'll spend a little bit of time here going over markets.
Yeah, we had some good macro data come out. Good. Market moving macro data come out this week, let's say, and how that affected markets with the S&P 500. Looks like it's down on the week, down week to date, down 94 basis points as of the close today. So putting that for a year to date return of down over 18%. The winners this week, we actually have a positive print. It just turned positive in the last few hours of the day here, it looks like. But consumer staples leading the way up 8 basis points. On the flip side is a little familiar sector now on the negative return side is energy. Energy sector down over 3% week to date, still up over 26% on the year to date basis, though. Looks like energy's been pricing in a lot of that. The fears of a recession, so some of the macro risk out there has been hidden. Not only energy, but I guess some of the other areas within commodities that are more economically sensitive, like industrial metals as well. That's kind of been leading the way down. But over in fixed income land, it looks like you had a little bit of a mixed bag here this week with the two-year treasury note closing with a yield of 3.12%. That's 2 basis points higher than the close last Friday. And when we move down the curve, or out the curve on the 10-year treasury, it has a yield as of now, or at the close, at 2.92%. That is lower by 16 basis points over the previous week. So a bit of a rally at the belly of the curve here. And the long bond closed the week at 3.08 yield. That's in 16 basis points as well relative to last week. So a bit of a rally on the, I didn't mention it, but from the 5-year point of the curve out, the 2-year yield did increase a little bit there. This brought in the 2s-10s yield curve to spread to minus 20 basis points. And we were just commenting before, this is the two weeks now of inversion. Last week being a shortened week, so 4 days there and 5 days this week. So for us, that is firmly flashing a red signal now when it comes to being a recession warning signal there.
Yeah, and negative 20 basis points is just, it's a sizable number. It's not, we started last week at negative 2. So a pretty big move there. Interesting when you look at the curve, if you take out the 20-year, which has some sort of liquidity premium or a yield premium in it, it's the highest point in the curve. I've been 333. If you take out the 3 year is a little bit of a premium over the 2 year, but you kind of take out those two little outliers or those two treasuries with a that are a little bit more off the run or you know, not as widely traded, the 2 years are the highest point on the curve at 312. So
yeah.
Long bonds lower, 10 years lower, everything's lower.
Yeah, and with that that 20 years, just, I mean, people might be scratching their head because they don't, you know, seem to recall that that issue being offered, but it had been historically. It's been a while since the Treasury pulled it out, but just pulling it up while you're talking here, the 20-year Treasury reemerged in the depths of the pandemic there. So it looks like the first print I see here in terms of yield goes back to May 21st, 2020. So just about 2 months after we all went on lockdown here in the U.S. at least. So it's probably just facilitating some of that funding needs that that we desperately needed back then.
I think people were pushing for, you know, longer term, you know, 50-year treasuries, 100-year treasuries.
Yep.
So, you know, while people weren't really necessarily on board with issuing that, I guess issuing a 20-year, you know, the duration is very similar to a 30-year. So maybe that people took advantage, or you took advantage of, the Treasury took advantage of offering at the 20 year at those long, little bit longer durations without kind of overloading the long bond.
Yeah, that's right. So it does seem to be a little bit less popular in terms of the eyes of investors. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a little bit of a kink in the curve there. So I talked about earlier how the 10-year Treasury yield is at 292, the long bond 30 year is at 308. And when you look at the kink in the curve, the 20-year, that's offering a yield of 3.33. So definitely less popular for that liquidity yield premium that you mentioned there. So with the rally in the belly of the curve, we got a rally in the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate as well. That is up 1%, so more than offset the decline in the S&P 500 this week. The winners within the ag this week was the IG corporate credit market up about 1.25%, followed by the agency MBS component up just over 1%, it looks like, and then U.S. Treasuries up 80 basis points. But despite what we saw in terms of weakness in the U.S. equity market, in terms of large cap space, we did see some strength and with positive prints on the high yield U.S. corporate credit sector up 80 basis points as well, and then bank loans up 50 basis points this week. The one laggard within the cohort that we talk about on a weekly basis was the emerging market debt sector there. That was down over 2.25% on the week-to-date basis. Still the worst performer within this cohort, down over 22%.
Yeah, and even though that EM does have some duration, the spread widening certainly overwhelmed that duration in the fall, kind of the falling rate market.
Yeah, that's right. Then, you know, finally, moving over to the commodity side of things, commodities continue to show weakness, as it's been that the broad-based index has been in decline since, I want to say, early June or so. Nothing different this week. The Bloomberg commodity index down over 2% week to date, still up about 15 percentage points on a year-to-date basis, so still the best performer on a broad index basis amongst the various indices that we look at there. Looking at it here, WTI crude oil on the front month future went down below $100 a barrel. Today it sits at $97.52 a barrel. So it rallied a little bit in the last day or so, but it couldn't quite get back up above 100. So that's down about 7% on the week-to-date basis, still up on the front month contract, up about 30% on the year-to-date basis there. One of the headwinds there potentially as well is I'm looking at the dollar index, the DXY index that we look at comparing the dollar against a basket of other developed market currencies there. That's up about 1%. On the week to date and up 13% year to date, but it has had a strong quarter to date as well as the last 6 months as well there. So perhaps that's offering a little bit of that traditional headwind to the commodity price basket as well, as those tend to be negatively correlated.
Yeah, and the euro is kind of some talk about how the euro broke parity. Looking at the screen right now, it's just above it's at 1.008. So those of you that are traveling to Europe and aren't very math inclined, you can just assume it's one. now. So that's always a bonus when it's just one-to-one. You don't have to worry about, you know, you're spending more than you think because it's a, you know, because you're like, oh, this is cheap. It's a, you know, €5, but now it really is, you know, €5 is $5. So it's much easier to do that math in your head.
Yeah. So that's the other bonus there is just the relative pricing there. Things are definitely a lot cheaper as an American tourist going over to the countries that do use the euro there. And that just reminds me of also that I used to like around the time, you know, we're traveling internationally a little bit more when the Swiss franc was at a buck as well relative to the dollar. That was always a nice, easy conversion, right? So
don't waste your brain power or, your brain cells on that currency conversion.
That's right. Thankful for that. So I misspoke earlier. I said, finally getting into commodities. I forgot our little buddy here, the Bitcoin, to represent the broader digital asset space, I guess, rightly or wrongly. But today it seems to be holding in. It's just down 3% relative to where it closed or where we marked it last week. So it's still hanging on above 21,000 here, 21,000 and a little bit of change there, putting it down over 50% on a year-to-date basis through the time of this recording there. So not much love in Bitcoin this week, but not much hate relative to it last week as well. You know, for yeah, 3%, it's not too bad for Bitcoin, given the drop-off it's had.
Just talking about the volatility, you know, we always think, you know, commodities, highly volatile. You know, we're like, oh, it's a bad week, down 2%. And you're like, oh, Bitcoin, it's holding in there, only down 3%.
Yeah, yeah. So it's it's not too bad of a week for Bitcoin. And if you recall, it started the year right around 46,000. So 21,000 is a big drop for the year to date, but not so much on the week.
That's right.
So with that market roundup, do you want to kick us off on what happened this past week in the macro front?
Yeah, and let's jump right into the big data point for the week. And that was on Wednesday. We did get the CPI numbers for June. The numbers came in that exceeded expectations across the board. That's when you were talking about it was a market moving event, not necessarily a good print having high inflation. Headline CPI was up 1.3% month over month. It was expected to be 1.1, so a big miss there. The year-over-year number headline broke into the 9 handle with a 9.1%. It was expected to come in at 8.8. So, you know, inflation much higher than people were expecting. On the core, so ex food and energy was up 0.7%, was expected to be up 0.5, so a big miss there also. That brought the year-over-year number up to 5.9. Over the next 3 months, we have core month over month numbers rolling off of a 0.3, 0.2, and a 0.3. So we would expect that core CPI to remain elevated. But you know, again, if we do see these numbers, the year over year numbers continue to stay high, that's kind of expected at this point. Jim Bianco, one of the researchers who we follow pretty closely, he put together a couple of charts that said, if we get 0 month over month headline CPI for the rest of the year, so, you know, reminder, you know, headline CPI was 1.3 and core CPI was 0.7. So if we go to 0, we go from 1.3 to 0 and we go 0 for the rest of the year, headline CPI will still be 6.69% for the year through that's, you know, the December number. If we get 0 CPI for core or 0 month over month core CPI numbers for the rest of the year, we get 4.3%. So still well above the, the Fed's target rate there in terms of, you know, they don't target CPI, but you know, you do have that CPI to PCE difference, but certainly still it remains well above the Fed's 2% target.
Yeah, I was just going to say while you're talking there, it's been a while since we've seen anything at 0 or below in terms of month over month headline CPI, at least. It looks like the last time we had a close to a 0 or a negative print was back in May 31st of 2020. So, you know, maybe we're overdue, but it doesn't seem that way given the way that headline, or at least on the month over month headline, seems like it's been trending up a bit. So we'll see.
Yeah, I guess the only saving grace or the only possibility is because you've seen energy prices come down so much, whether it is in oil prices or gasoline prices, that there could be, you know, some deflation in the headline CPI, but still it's a pretty big number to overcome.
Yeah, it has been tough too. I mean, especially with OER continuing to rise month for month and the amount of weight it occupies in both the you know, the headline as well as the bigger allocation within the core segment. So that's one of the things that you and I have been talking about for a while here. So it seems like, unfortunately, it's coming to fruition, but, as our rents, right? I mean, we've been seeing rent, we've been seeing and hearing about rents on the rise in some of these other cities. But on the flip side, you're starting to see some of these other metropolitan areas that kind of got inflated in prices. Those are kind of coming back to reality as people are finding that they're probably have to go back to work a little bit sooner than they thought in terms of in a physical setting. So, you know, those areas like perhaps Boise or you know, areas outside of the norm are starting to look a little bit less attractive. So, right. See some price relief there at least.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. We don't get it. We're not going to front run ourselves. We don't get home prices this next week, but it's the week after. I think they get it right before the Fed meeting. So they'll at least have that data point. They'll have the data point on how housing prices are moving before they make their decision.
Yeah. Things are, I mean, just from what we've been hearing, things are starting to look a little bit more tenuous for housing prices there. So let's watch for that.
Yep. Thursday, we did get the PPI numbers for June. Again, higher than expected. The month over month number was 1.1% versus a 0.8% expectation. And the year over year number was up to 11.3. So kind of confirming the CPI report, nothing, wasn't really market moving. This morning, we did get the retail sales number. That was actually pretty strong. This is for June. It was up 1.0%. The retail sales ex autos and gas was up 0.7%. And then the so-called control group was up 0.8%. And that control group number was expected to be 0.5. So still well above expectations there. So the consumer remains strong. So that's a positive, at least for the economy. And then, something that, you know, Sam, you and I always look at we dismiss because it's a survey-based number. And, you know, when you survey 500 people and according to Jay Powell, they made some changes to the Fed policy based on this survey of 500 people, but the University of Michigan 5-to-10-year inflation expectations number came out. This is the preliminary number, and that number fell from 3.0 to 2.8%. And with that, we didn't talk about it when we're talking about the CPI, but because that CPI number was so strong, people were starting to talk about, is the Fed going to raise 100 basis points in July? Versus the 75 that was priced into the market. And at the end of the day, Wednesday, and kind of intraday Thursday, that number went up from 60% of 100 basis point rate hike to about 90%+ intraday Thursday, I think I saw at one point. And then with this University of Michigan inflation expectations number kind of falling back down to, within the more normal range, even though it was only down by 0.2%, the probability of 100 basis point hike has fallen down to 20% or so. So it doesn't seem like that's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. And with that, we also did get, part of the Fed speak that was kind of toking that 100 basis point Fed rate hike was Bostic was out there on Wednesday saying, quote, everything is in play. When they were asked about whether they could hike under 100 basis points, Mester said, we don't have to make that decision today. There's more data coming out that I'm going to be very attuned to. So hopefully that I don't know if that retail sales number, I think that would make them more likely to raise 100 basis points because the economy can handle it. But certainly the housing prices are going to be important there. Daly from San Francisco Fed came out and said, my most likely posture is 75 because of the data I've seen. And then this morning, or I think yesterday, Waller, who has been very much ahead of the curve in terms of talking about Fed rate hikes and talking about the size of Fed rate hikes and increasing the size of hikes. He said that he supports another 75 basis point increase. He did say, but it depends on the incoming data. And then he did note that they have important data releases on retail sales. So this was something he said yesterday on Thursday, important data releases on retail sales and housing coming in before the July meeting. So it'll be interesting to see if we get if housing remains very strong, then is the Fed more likely to go to 100 basis point increase? If housing comes in slightly weaker, do they settle for 75? Market right now is still saying 75, but we'll see how the data comes out over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely came out in force and just talked down some of the expectations there, the initial knee-jerk expectations that the market had for 100 basis points. We saw it in 2 year too. I mean, the 2 year, right after the CPI print, and then the following day, it did spike up a little bit higher relative to where it closed this Friday, but it got up, looking at it now, it got up as high as almost 327 on the 2 year yield. And again, just as a reminder, it closed around 313. So backed off a little bit as these talking heads came out and pulled back on some of the guidance there.
Yeah, and you know, they certainly had the opportunity just to talk about how hundreds in the toolbox that they would think about doing 100. So I think that barring some sort of last minute shift, I think we'll probably get a 75 basis point hike here in July.
Yeah, it seems like it. But one of the things too is, you know, we've been on hiatus for a little bit, given in the spirit of summer and summer doldrums there. But we did get a question this week, kind of by way of a webcast that Jeff Sherman had, where he did take, where he does take listener questions at the end. This one was a little bit less related to the topic at hand that the webcast that Sherman gave. So he offered to pass it on to us. So the question came from a webcast listener that day by the name of Dan. Dan, Sherman pointed you here. So hopefully you found your way to our Monday Morning Minutes podcast. And we are going to answer or attempt to answer your question here. And your question was, what indicator do you think is now the best predictor of what commodity prices will do going forward? So in an attempt to answer that, I think Mayberry and I are both going to kind of take a stab from different angles here. And as you would expect, I guess there's no one indicator, but instead it's an amalgamation of a number of things that we take a look at to help formulate our opinions in terms of where directionality of certain assets might be going. So Jeff, do you want to kick us off with what you're thinking?
Yeah, I think that if there was a predictor or if there was an indicator, we would certainly use it in our commodity strategies. But as you said, Sam, there really isn't one there. I think that when people, when we do talk about the commodities, we talk about the Bloomberg Commodity Index. If you kind of break it down between the kind of four large sectors, the Bloomberg commodities, 40% energy, 15% precious metals, so silver and gold. 10% industrial metals, and then 24% agriculture. The other big commodity index out there that is traded a lot is the S&P GSCI index. That one is much more heavily weighted towards energy. So it's 65% energy. It's only 4% precious metals, 8.5% industrial metals, and then 23% agriculture. So it's a much heavier weight to energy. So when you look at the divergences between the two indices, typically it is very much due to how is the energy complex moved on that day. Now, really, when you look at, when you look at things also, you have to remember that the BCOM has very high weightings to natural gas. So about 13% of the BCOM is in natural gas. Also has 11% weighting to gold, 9%, or 15, let's call it 15% combined in WTI, so West Texas Intermediate, and Brent crude oils. So it's a very top heavy index in the Brent or in the BCOM. And so you have to remember that it is kind of a diversified index also. And so, we always talk about how commodities overall aren't really correlated to, they're not correlated to your equities. They're not correlated to your fixed income. They're a diversifier. And really, when you look at it, there's diversification within that diversification. So, we always like to say, why would soybeans have the same price movement or same correlation? They're not going to be highly correlated to something like natural gas or crude oil. And certainly they over time, have shown very low correlations. And certainly one of the things that we do look at though is momentum. And so commodities do tend to trade with a very high kind of momentum factor. They do trade with momentum. But you really have to look at the breadth of the commodity market. You have to look at the individual, either pieces or individual sectors of the commodity market when you're trying to decide, what the general direction of the commodity market is or what the predictor of the commodity prices will do. And so when we like to look at it, we like to look at the different momentum in the different sectors. So, looking at, I just chose year to date because it's a nice, easy, we have a long enough time period that it makes sense to look at the year-to-date returns. but this will show you how much their differences there could be. Unsurprisingly, the BCOM energy index is up 63% year to date. The Bloomberg commodity industrial metals is down 18.5%. So just right there, those two large pieces have moved in very, very strong opposite directions. The precious metals index is down 10%. And then the agricultural index is you know, relatively flat at only up 5%. And so that's why I think it's important to look at different pieces. You can't really just say, look at the best predictor of commodity market overall, because there's so many different moving pieces. People tend to think about energy. They tend to think about energy driving the commodity markets. And a lot of that is because of, energy is 40% of the BCOM, 65% of the GSCI index. And so it does drive a lot of the overall returns of the commodity market, as does the energy market. And so I think that that's really something that, that's why we talk about when we talk about oil, we talk about it in terms of the commodity market and how its effect is on the commodity market overall. So if you're going to have to choose one predictor, certainly look at oil momentum, but that's really more on the technical side of things. That's more on just looking at prices, their movements. And it's really hard to time, but I think from a longer term, Sam, you want to talk about kind of the macro side, what we're seeing kind of drivers, I think of longer term. And so even if you think that, prices are going to go down over the short term in oil or commodities overall, what's the long-term outlook for commodities, based on larger macro factors?
Yeah. And as you hinted at there, or actually talked about there too, is with commodities, they all, within the various complexes, they do trade relative to their own supply and demand fundamentals, as commodities themselves are a very heterogeneous type of set of various investment vehicles there. So energy might behave differently than industrial metals. Both might be sensitive to economic growth, but it seems like industrial metals tends to be a little bit more economically sensitive to the longer run picture, whereas energy may be a little bit more contemporaneous reactions there. We started to see as economic data started to weaken beginning at the end of last year, you saw industrial metals kind of lead the way in terms of weakness coming down, especially with copper, which is down over 30% from its highs, I want to say, maybe from February or March of this year, probably March of this year, whereas energy is starting to catch up a little bit more now as the idea of potential recession risk becomes more elevated as we progress through 2022. But one of the things actually, just before I get into the macro, one of the things that we look at here when we think about commodities and the way that we design our strategy is that the futures curve, commodity futures that we always talk about and when we talk about our market roundup there, is commodity futures in itself, the shape of the curve can tell you a lot about the way that the market is thinking about the future. The potential price movements, directions, and trends within each individual commodities. If a commodity is, I'm going to use some jargon here, but I was looking up while you talked, Jeff, you and I did a Monday Morning Minutes on January 14th of this year talking about commodity futures and the shape of the curve and how that could inform decisions on whether or not you want to be long or short. But if any of the jargon here doesn't make sense, I encourage you to take a look at that episode. Again, January 14th, 2022 is when we recorded it. But if something is in backwardation, that is one way to make a consideration for being long a commodity, just because through the mechanics of rolling the futures, the overall return can be accreted based on that roll mechanism as prices move higher, closer towards as you near expiration relative to where you bought it. And then the flip side is contango. So the shape of the futures curve is one indicator potentially for longer term returns in commodities. But what we've seen recently, I think, in terms of if we break it down to what we've seen in 2022 and more near term outlook, I think recession fears are really what's been driving commodity prices. So indicators there would be more of the economic growth and contraction indicators that Jeff and I talk about on a weekly basis here on Monday Morning Minutes as they come up. But if you're to take a look at it, and we do have some manufacturing PMI numbers coming out next week. It's either manufacturing and or servicing or both. Or I guess that's what the and or is for. But PMI data typically is a good starting point because it does come out with decent frequency, about once a, or it does come out once a month, much better than trying to gauge it based on GDP numbers as they come out on the lag. Something else, you know, as I'm thinking through it, the New York Fed puts out this, I believe it's the New York Fed, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but they put out the weekly economic index, which is, it's an aggregator of, more timely aggregator of multiple data points. And that comes out, as the name suggests, on a weekly basis. So that can give you a sense of where economic strength in the U.S. is going, at least. But these can be useful in assessing aggregate demand here in the U.S. But as you mentioned earlier, you know, given that commodities are a global asset, you know, you have to take in consideration the global economy. So when we look overseas, there are certainly heightened macro concerns around China as a result largely of its zero COVID policy and the idea that China can shut down parts of its economy with very little, if no notice, even to their citizens. And then also in the EU, you have similar concerns around economic slowing that we have here, but that's been exacerbated by this energy disruption out of Russia there. So, you know, overall, I think this macro backdrop has been the driver of commodity prices lately, namely the weakness that we've seen across the broad complex, as I mentioned earlier, starting with industrial metals, which are more sensitive to kind of an early indicator for economic growth, with copper being appropriately nicknamed Dr. Copper for having a PhD in the economy. But now it's starting to weigh in on the energy complex. You know, looking at WTI crude oil and also Brent crude oil, it's, you know, you can see that we're back to those pre-Ukraine war premium levels that we reached in both of those futures contracts. So it's kind of, you know, right between this 90 to 100 level, it, to me, is more of a reasonable level given that supply backdrop that you alluded to, Jeff, where there may be a supply deficit that we're currently running, which I actually think we are in a bit of a supply deficit, even in oil here, as despite the drop off that we had. Because when you take a look at U.S. crude oil inventories in aggregate, I mean, the headline number of what's available for sale, as well as the inventory of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, when you look at that in aggregate, we're at the lowest levels going back to the mid-80s. And that's a problem that is not going to be solved easily. I mean, they have to basically produce more oil for everyday use, as well as build back the inventories that we've depleted out of that the SPR of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, currently unloading about at a run rate of about 1 million barrels a day. So with that, we've been taking out that inventory and putting it out for sale in the market from our emergency stash. So I think, you know, what's interesting is this continued decline in this aggregate level of inventory. This decline in supply has been concurrent with this rise in oil production that we've had since the pandemic. So I think that's just evidence of a continued supply and demand imbalance in U.S. crude oil, at least. But as we pointed out in the past, that's also evident in the global energy inventories as well when we look across OECD countries. So whilst today I think the macro fear of recession is overwhelming this kind of supply side argument, I do think we need to continue to watch to see how that develops, because we do have this underpinning of supply deficit, not only in crude oil, but also in a number of the industrial metals on a kind of a longer term demand basis. So these are kind of things that's, again, they're not really indicators. It's a little bit squishy, but these are some of the things that you know, we think about when we think about the directionality of commodity prices across both the subsectors, the subcomplexes, but then also the broad commodity complex.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, there's all this talk about recession. Commodities are, you know, I wouldn't say signaling recession, but certainly recession worries out there are weighing on commodities. And, you know, while the stock market was down, or S&P was down 1% this week, you know, still on the month, it's still up 2%. And so it's a weird dichotomy there between who's right. Is the stock market right, and things are going to be okay, or we get the quote unquote softish landing? Or it's kind of the commodity and, you know, the long bond or you know, 10-year, 30-year bond traders, right? Where, you know, recession, if we're not, if it's not right around the corner, you know, some people say we're already in a recession. So, you know, they'll probably point to the two months or two quarters of negative GDP as being in a recession, or negative real GDP as being in a recession. But certainly, you know, it doesn't seem like, it seems like it'll be hard to get, you know, it's hard to say we're in a recession given the labor market, but it's just a weird, you know, I think we talked about it last week, but we're in a weird place where, you know, depending on what your outlook is or what you want your outlook to be, you can point to all this data that kind of confirms, you know, confirms it either way.
Yeah. And one thing I was thinking about too, is if you want to get into kind of the micro in terms of formulating your own indicators, these aren't, at least in my knowledge, readily available to the public, but you can cobble it together with information that's provided on when we're looking at crude oil and the various distillates, as well as other oil-based products. You can always go to, it's either the Department of Energy or the sub-agency, the Energy Institute of America, the EIA, their websites. You can cobble together inventory as well as usage of that inventory to kind of give you a sense of what they call a stocks to use ratio. That'll give you it's essentially a coverage ratio and give you a sense of what inventories look like relative to consumption. But you and I discussed this on a, what do we call it? It's not a podcast. It's on the Channel 11 that by Kenny, Ken Shinoda, that he has on the YouTube channel. We talked about this a few months ago and pointed out that the stocks to use ratio, again, inventory divided by consumption, is at a multi-decade low. And at the time, if I recall correctly, that was at a point where it was near the lowest on record as well. It doesn't go that far back, I think back to the 80s or so, but it was near the lowest on record. And that continues to be the case despite the sell-off that we've seen in the last 1.5 months in oil. You can do something similar again. They provide it with the, I don't know if it's the USDA or one of the sub agencies there that'll provide it for the various crops that we have as well, where you can create your own type of stocks to use ratio for that. And then metals, I remember, has always been a little bit more difficult. But there, I did track down one of the sources that we used in that compendium of the commodity deck that we use for Kenny's Channel 11. For metals, there's something called the World Bureau of Metal Statistics that's commonly cited for these stocks to use as well, to just give you a sense of what the coverage ratio is of these various commodities relative to the consumption. And with that, I don't know if the World Bureau of Metal Statistics is a paid or free service, but you and I, unfortunately, we typically get that stuff from the sell side research that has all that as a one-stop shop. But those are a couple of the things that you can take a look at if you really want to dive into the various commodities that underlie the broader complex. But overall, I mean, I think right now it's just the macro that's kind of dictating the trend, and that's overwhelming the fundamental side in many of these commodities here.
Yeah, and I think when, you know, on that Channel 11 episode, it was season 3, episode 4 that you and I made our appearance. We talked about how the Fed can only control the demand side. They can't really control the supply side of commodities. And certainly they've done some pretty good work there on the demand side. And whether that's going to lead to a recession or not remains to be seen. But, you know, they certainly have slowed down the or at least anecdotally, they've slowed down. We've yet to see it really in any sort of official data. But anecdotally, they've slowed down at least, you know, housing or in, and maybe the consumer remains strong as seen by the retail sales numbers today. But really looking at it, I think that the Fed is on their way to, you know, getting that more, that supply demand imbalance, more imbalance, whether it's on, you know, the labor market side of things, whether it's on the commodity market side of things. And once that kind of turns around, then it's going to take a little bit of time for that to kind of work itself out. But then I think you could see the commodity market turn around and bounce off the, you know, commodity market overall. If you want to kind of label it all together, but have, you know, see the energy side and industrial metal side kind of bounce on the back of improving demand from consumers or from the global consumers.
Yeah. And, you know, before earlier this morning, we were talking about how much copper has really fallen. It's just, again, I think I referenced it over 30% from its highs. It's down 26% on a year to date basis there. So it's definitely been pricing in a weaker economic activity there, and it's starting to, you know, at least get our attention in terms of potentially trying to figure out ways to perhaps get a little bit of exposure there, given the price that's at now. But, you know, if recession is in the cards, which I do think it is, then, you know, perhaps you have to kind of take a little bit more of an adjustment there relative to the price level that's at. I think it is maybe a little bit more weakness to be had. But at some point, I mean, this drop in copper relative to this supply, potential for a supply issue that I think, you know, people are becoming more and more aware of. I just saw this S&P Global, or it might've been Market, S&P bought out, put out this report. I haven't gone through it yet. I think it's 120 something pages there, but they're talking about outlining the supply deficit that we're going to have in copper and across a number of metals, given this kind of unified goal of reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050. If that's the goal, and if we're trying to be on track on that, then we're going to need a lot more copper and other industrial metals, more than two times the historical demand for it or use for it, based on the summary that I read. So a lot needs to be done for us to get there. So it does look like, at least in a number of areas across U.S. energy and global energy production, as well as industrial metals mining, a lot needs to be invested in to build out that production capability relative to the amount of demand that is anticipated.
Right. So check out that, you know, if you'd like to look at charts instead of just hearing us talk about it, we have some charts there on that Channel 11 episode, Season 3, Episode 4. With that, we'll get into the things to keep an eye on for next week. A pretty quiet week. On Thursday, we get, as usual, the jobless claims data. Initial claims are expected to be 240,000 versus 244,000 the prior week. And continuing claims, 1.345 million. Pretty steady numbers versus last week. So, you know, we'll continue to keep an eye on the jobless claims numbers. We don't talk about them every week because they are pretty much steady as she goes. But if we do start to see some upticks, then we'll be sure to talk about it on the next episode. On Thursday, we also get the LEI. That number is expected to fall 0.5%. So fall two is negative 0.5%. We have a positive 0.6% rolling off. So that brings the year-over-year number to 2.0%, or, you know, around, give or take, 2.0%. This will be the fourth consecutive monthly decline in the LEI. And then on the bad news front, we have a 1.0 and a 0.7 rolling off in the next 2 months. So if we got zero numbers for the next 2 months, kind of like as we were projecting out our CPI, if we get zero, this is what's going to happen. If we get zero, we'll be a very slight positive. If we get any sort of negative numbers in the next 2 months, this number could turn negative. And if it does turn negative, then that would be another signal for a recession. So we have the twos, tens curve negative for nine consecutive business days. So that's certainly a negative signal for a recession. That's much more of a longer term recession in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months or so. The LEI as would be another, I wanted to say feather in your cap, but it's not a good thing. Another, indicator saying recession is on its way. So as we kind of compile more and more of these indicators, it seems much more likely that a recession is coming, if not in 2022, certainly in 2023. But if we look at the numbers coming out on Friday, we get the S&P Global, formerly known as Market with an I. We get both the manufacturing and services PMIs numbers. Those are the July preliminary numbers. The manufacturing is expected to be 52.0 and the services at 52.6. So still above 50, still expansionary and kind of flat versus last month. But using these indicators, we haven't gone to a contractionary mode yet. So we would, you know, another recession indicator, Sam, as you mentioned earlier, we would need those to go below 50 to have another tally mark in terms of recession. And then lastly, the Fed blackout starts tomorrow. So we won't get any more Fed speak, which is why there was a lot of Fed speak this week, because they all wanted to cram it in before they couldn't talk. But because it is the blackout, check the Wall Street Journal and Nick Timiraos to see if anything changes and what the Fed's thinking when they can't go out and speak publicly.
Yeah, I mean, given the quiet week that in terms of economic data that's coming out, hopefully we won't see the side channel being used again like it was last time. But who knows? I mean, we've seen Powell come out and use indicators that no one ever really considered to be market moving in the past. But again, it's, you know, fishing for data that fits your position. So anything could happen here.
That's right. But, you know, maybe we'll start looking at, you know, I'm just looking at the what actually is coming out, not necessarily the important ones. You know, maybe it's the Philly Fed business outlook that he'll point to this time, and you know, have to drop a word that they're thinking about 100 instead of 75.
Yeah, or, you know, something else outside of the U.S. that's going on. You know, some kinds of things that I guess we could be that are on the table now with good old Powell, Jay Powell at the helm. So he's keeping us guessing. But with that, you know, hopefully if we get any questions of the week, feel free to submit them. Otherwise, Sherman might foist a couple more on us, and we can see if we can address those as well. But send in those questions if you want us to address them on the Monday Morning Minutes.
And it was definitely a foist.
It was a foist, yeah. So all hopefully right, well, Dan wasn't offended by that in terms of not getting his question answered at that time, but hopefully he tuned in to Monday Morning Minutes and got the answers he was looking for. Or, was, yeah, not
what, not looking what he for, was but. Looking for, but certainly our answer was much more in depth than, you know, what Sherman would have given on a webcast. You know, he would have given, you know, 30 seconds to a minute, whereas Dan got an extended answer from us.
Indeed.
Well, I think that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening to us out there today. Monday Morning Minutes, it should be available on any of your favorite podcast platforms there. If you can't find it, or if you have questions, you got comments, you got suggestions, send us an email at minutes@doubleline.com or hit us up on Twitter at DLine Minutes.
Yeah, you can check out our website, doubleline.com. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. Where you can see that Channel 11 episode that Sam and I were in a couple months ago. And also we just dropped a new video or a slides/ video of Ryan Kimmel discussing his team's new piece on finding a bottom in equities. So it's very useful given where we are in the stock market today. And don't forget to subscribe to Sam's other podcast, The Sherman Show. You can follow them on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Thanks, everyone. Good luck out there.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.